But I mean, it depends on who you ask. Some would say, you know, it's based on when they're conscious. Well, then what do you do if someone is unconscious? Are you no longer a person when you sleep?
Right.
Are you no longer a person if you're in a coma?
Right.
So then they move the goalposts
exactly
again.
Right.
Well, it has to do with when they're viable. Okay, well, I mean, children aren't viable for a very long time after they're born.
Yeah, I mean, your college student's hardly viable. You know what I'm saying?
Welcome back to Reason Together, the podcast for Christians who think about stuff. I'm Thomas, here with my friend Daniel for episode number 79. How are you, Daniel?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I was just thinking it's neat to have the opportunity. You know, we enjoy talking, but I mean, to just like, in essence, walk into your office and somebody hands you 3x5 cards and says, talk about these four topics today. You know, it's just kind of fun to like just
happen?
Sit down and bat them back and forth. Well, essentially that does, because as we sit down and we look into our discussion panel here, we've got some listener feedback and a listener question and things we've been thinking about. And just like, this is great, you know, to just be able to walk in and have something to bat around.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
especially
fun.
From the, you know, from listeners and patrons too.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So what have you been up to? Anything new?
Like I said last time, I've started back to schooling. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't flunked yet, and that's good. No, it's been good. I feel like it's kind of the, you know, like a maybe a deep stir, you know. I mean, really it's good thought provoking, and mm-hmm. I'm enjoying that. And then my pastor is to Israel, in Israel with his wife now, so I'm excited for them. And then that gives me the opportunity to cover the preaching and things while he's gone. And so, last Sunday, I preached another message on technology principles undergirding, you know, kind of the use of technology in the home. And in the morning, I had the privilege of dealing with God's design for, you know, intimacy in marriage, the roles in marriage, and then children, kind of because it was Sanctity of Life Sunday, kind of laying a foundation for how to view children and that whole, you know, kind of a biblical case there for how to view that subject. So that was enjoyable.
Good.
Yeah.
I actually have something I'm going to bring up in a little while about technology that maybe, since it's fresh on your mind, will be a helpful thing to talk about.
Okay.
That good. Sounds
how
like a neat
you?
Trip, though, about Israel. You've never been there, have you?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, me neither.
And honestly, I'll have to say, in the past, I was kind of like, yeah, you know, I mean, I just didn't feel like this great urge to go there, but it's growing more now. I think part of my concern before was to say, I don't want to go there and see all this stuff and then come back and be like, and then study my Bible and be like, well, I was there, but I don't remember. You know, I mean, I want to, it's like, I want to know a lot going into it so that I start correlating things as I'm there.
Yeah.
Or have a really good guide too, you know, who says, hey, you know what happened in this city? This happened and this happened. So-and-so was healed and this happened. Oh, okay. You know, and then get a visual.
Maybe it would be something to do that would be better if you were an older preacher. Mm-hmm. Like if we were older preachers, you know, like, like 60 plus, you know, you know, cause you know, by then we'll have, you know, a few decades of preaching through the Bible, you know, under our belt and maybe it would be a more fruitful trip in
possibly
some ways.
Because you've studied it and you've thought about it from a study perspective and now you get to see it and kind of link it together visually, you know, maybe a little earlier than that, but I don't know if that'll happen. So anyway, it sounds like you're kind of getting over, or you had a cold or you have a cold.
I'm on the tail end of one. I made it through all of 2019 without getting sick. And of course,
really?
Now that I'm in black belt boot camp, I get the sniffles.
I thought about that. It might have made Saturday a little difficult, huh? If Saturday weren't difficult.
Yeah, even. not as much as I thought. I made sure to do everything to possibly mitigate the effect it would have on boot camp class on Saturday. so it wasn't too bad. But
good.
I'm pretty much over it now. I'm just constantly sore is the thing all the time. I'm just really sore.
I bet.
So what do we have today for topics?
Well, I've got some feedback And we've got feedback from, or a question here from a patron. And I just want to take a minute to say thank you to our patrons over at patreon.com/reasontogether.
Yes.
All of you that are pitching in on a per episode basis and helping to support this, we sure appreciate it. And look forward to giving you some news in the future as far as how, what we're doing to move forward. But thank you for your support, for your listenership. And that being said, somebody approached me here a couple days ago about our last episode. So they're kind of right on top of it with talking about IVF.
Mm-hmm.
And in the conversation, number one, I think there was a little bit of maybe confusion as far as what we had said regarding eggs that were fertilized and left in the petri dish, if you will, in the lab. And mm-hmm. I clarified that, when I said those things handled responsibly, I mean, it's not an option to fertilize an egg and then throw it away.
Correct.
Yeah, that was not an option. Now, is implantation, I have to ask this because I don't know, honestly, is implantation speaking of just the reinsertion of the fertilized eggs, or is it speaking to the attachment of the eggs to the uterine wall?
The second part, the latter there.
Okay.
Implantation is when the blastocyst, by that point it would be called, is implanting itself into the wall of the uterine lining.
Okay. Now, when they reinsert the fertilized eggs, it's not a given that they'll implant, right? It's the hope that they will, because once they implant, it's kind of quite likely that one would fully develop.
Yeah, that I would need to do some more research on. I'm not sure exactly what their procedure is for implantation. Okay. So I'd have to think more on that.
And to restate for anybody who's kind of rejoining the conversation or joining it for the first time, we had talked about in vitro fertilization, and we don't claim to be professionals on this. No. We claim to be, two Christian brothers who are just trying to sort it out and see what moral issues might present themselves.
Yeah. And my only claim with it is that I had to study the anatomy and physiology of all of that in radiology school. So.
So you're on the medical side. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not a doctor. I'm not.
Right.
We're
not giving medical advice. But one of the concerns, and I could see this, I can understand it, is to say if they've given you medication to increase, given the woman medication to increase production. Mm-hmm. And then they harvest more eggs, and so they're putting into, they're fertilizing and then reinserting into the woman more eggs than would have been there at any normal time, typically.
Correct.
Probably like 6, 10, 12, whatever it may be.
I'm not sure it's that high, but...
Okay, maybe not.
I think on average it's 3 or 4.
Okay. And so in that case, that helps me because we didn't know numbers there, and saying if you insert 10 or 12, they're not going to all survive.
Yeah.
And so again, you're dealing with the issue that in a sense, you're throwing them away even though you didn't.
Well,
but
I mean,
it's 3 or 4, there is a possibility that they could, right?
They do have to function from also the standpoint of there is the possibility that all of them could implant and actually develop.
Right, and that has happened, hasn't it?
It has happened. Now, it is rare with IVF. The success rate is 50% or lower. But I mean, it has to be a what if. What if all of these were to implant successfully and develop successfully?
Right.
That would be pretty traumatic to have 12. I don't think that's humanly possible. 12?
Right. So I guess that was the concern. If they're putting in that many, they're not going to all make it.
Right.
So would that essentially be throwing them away, and would that be a problem? And I could say, I could see the case for that. But if it's a lower number and they all could be, viable and whatever, not as much of an issue. But
yeah, and I would have to defer to someone with more expertise on that, and maybe in particular someone who's actually been through that process would know how many are typically harvested and implanted.
I
would have to defer to them.
Yeah. Do you want to read the other feedback that we got on the same issue there?
Sure. Let me pull that up here. Okay. This one says, your podcast seems to bring up a topic and you both are able to expose multiple angles on it. By the end, a personal decision can and should be achieved based on your conclusions. If I could add a verse that I have used for this topic in counseling, Galatians 4:27. I believe the context is making a comparison to the Jews and the beginning church, but could this be applied for those who cannot have children? A teacher that is barren, for example, has many children as her, quote, her children in class, the junior church director, youth pastor, etc. Thanks. And so that's feedback there on that subject, offering a verse for counseling. Did you look that up?
Now, yeah, the verse is Galatians 4:27 says, "For it is written, rejoice, thou barren that bearest not. Break forth and cry, thou that travailest not, for the desolate hath many more children than she which hath an husband."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. You go ahead and give me your take on that.
It's a challenging verse. Mm-hmm. It's actually a quote from Isaiah chapter 54. In verse 1, "Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord." So he's actually quoting the Old Testament. He's suggesting that you'd have to look at the whole chapter, but there's a context in which he talks about a heavenly Jerusalem. The Jerusalem that is above is essentially like the birth mother of all the genuinely saved. I know that sounds weird on its face, but read the context of the chapter and that will make more sense. As a result, she rejoices, similarly to Sarah, who by miraculous means, though barren, had a child and then ultimately many descendants. She with hath an husband, most see that as a reference back to Hagar, because there was a physical relationship, a natural relationship that resulted from Hagar's and Abraham's union there, whereas it was more supernatural between Abraham and Sarah. There was a supernatural opening of the womb. Ultimately, what he's comparing in that chapter is the law-keeping for justification that the Judaizers preached, which produces nothing, versus salvation or justification by grace, which
is a supernatural act.
A supernatural act, not really illustrative of a physical or earthly Jerusalem, but the idea of a heavenly Jerusalem. So he's trying to give you the picture there of a supernatural justification or new birth by grace.
That's interesting. So his question is, could that be applied to those who cannot have children? I think, you know, you have to understand it just like any Bible passage in context, and you've laid out a nice explanation there. Now, could we take that as sort of a reminder in a way? I don't even know if I could say I would apply it, because that's not what the passage is talking about in a sense. But, you know, some might disagree with me on it. But I'm saying what you could say is that, look, when God gets involved, you know, things can happen and there can be joy that couldn't be otherwise. That would be my take on it if I was going to try to quote unquote apply it. And what he's saying is, could you change your perspective as, say, a nursery worker or a junior church director or youth pastor, and say, even if I can't have kids, I have the ability to minister to kids and to develop an influence with them and a close relationship with them, and I care about them and they bring me joy and God's giving me joy in the ministry. So that's a neat perspective to say, if I can't have kids, in a sense, a lot of people would call that my adopted kids.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, this is a close friend. She's our adopted daughter or whatever. Yeah. And what he's saying, I guess, is that you can have the perspective. That's what I assume. I feel like he's saying is that you can have the perspective in ministry that if you can have children of your own, you can still minister to children and God can give you joy there. Do you feel like that's what he's saying?
Yeah.
Am I reading that right?
I think that's probably what he's saying there in his feedback. I wonder if sometimes there is precedent for using a verse outside of its context like that, since in a way that may be what Paul is doing here. If he's quoting Isaiah 54, if that has a different context than what using in Galatians 4, then he's essentially doing the same thing.
That's a whole nother study, though, an intriguing question. Yeah. The use of the Old Testament and the New Testament, Paul's quoting of verses, and sometimes you're like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't seem like he's using it the same way it was used.
And, yeah. Now, I don't know that that would give us blanket precedent to do that with any verse we choose.
right. That's going to go everywhere.
Yeah. But I think it does maybe offer some justification for using that with verses in which that has been done in Scripture. Would you say? To use it the same way is what I'm saying.
The same way as what? I mean,
For instance, let's go back to this. If Paul is quoting Isaiah 54, which I'm not sure what the context is. I haven't looked at it. But if he's using that in Galatians 4 for a different subject, in other words, he's taking it out of its context, I would say that that's precedent to then use Galatians 4 in the Galatians 4 context, outside of the Isaiah 54 context.
Sure.
Because
well, yes.
That's what Scripture did.
Well, because it is Scripture, and if you believe that Scripture was inspired and that that's God's that's God's design and desire right there, then
yeah,
you know what I mean? Then, yeah, obviously you have to say, well, yeah, it was justified to apply it that way.
Yeah.
But I don't think you could say, now I'm justified in applying it every other way. I mean,
exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. But anyway, getting back to the whole, you know, context about the barren woman here, it was an important subject. Which is why it's brought up in Isaiah 54. If you think about that from the cultural context and the historical context of what a Jewish woman would have believed, they were expecting a promised seed.
And so barrenness was quite a
curse,
if you will, a blight.
Yeah, essentially saying, well, it's not going to be through you. it would have been viewed as very, very... what's the word I'm looking for? It would have been depressing.
Disheartening.
Disheartening. That's it. That's the word. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, let me throw another one out at you, kind of in our political climate where, there's constantly talking about racial discrimination and that, and now you've got the whole gender issue and everything that's branched off of that and LGBTQ plus, et cetera. So the question, I think I've heard it equated that slavery is equivalent to LGBTQ discrimination. You know, basically racial discrimination is the same thing as or is similar to, falls in the same category as LGBTQ discrimination. What's your take on that?
My take is it depends on whether or not a person believes that gender is fluid or that their sexual orientation is changeable. I personally believe that that it is not. It's given to you by God. if you're born male, that's what you are. If you're born female, that's what you are. Okay.
It's a biological distinction.
It is a biological distinction. Yes. Mm-hmm. I personally think that to think otherwise is tantamount to what is today called science denial. It's just obvious. It's just obvious. You are what you are. though that maybe lends more to the discussion of transgenderism than it does specifically to the gay or lesbian discussion, though related, not exactly the same discussion.
Right, true.
But if something can change like that, if someone can go from being heterosexual to homosexual, I don't know that you can equate it to racial discrimination if that person is then persecuted for that. Mm-hmm. Because
for what reason?
You can't change your skin color. At least not normally.
right.
You're born with your skin color. That's what you are. And essentially, if you get persecuted for that, people are persecuting you for something you can't change about yourself. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone who says, you know, comes out and says, you know, I'm gay. Well, they just changed to that. They weren't always that way. Mm-hmm. They could simply change... go the other way now.
Go back.
They could go back.
Yeah, interesting. So, interesting point. If they could change one way, they could technically change the other.
Yeah. There's a lot more to say about that, though. But
sure, you want to say more? Go ahead.
No. I'm just saying we could talk the rest of the episode on that.
Oh yes, right. There's a lot to say about those issues.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that both of them are the same in one way. Racial discrimination and LGBTQ discrimination are the same in the sense that. The racial distinction is a man-made distinction because there's one race, the human race, but we divide on the color of the skin. We call them a different race. Well, that's a false man-made subsection of what actually exists. Well, in LGBTQ, it's the same thing. It's a false subsection of what actually exists. You know, there is your gender, and then they create this, you know, below it. Well, my gender can be fluid, so therefore I can be this. Well, no, not really, because this is what you are. This is what you're made. This is what you biologically are. And so I find them similar in that way, in that they're false man-made subsystems, but they're different just for the reason you said, is that, you know, actual color, if we define it correctly, not racial discrimination, but color discrimination, or, you know, ethnic discrimination, I guess, is something that you can't change, where the other one is basically just, well, would the nicest way to say it, and I guess we're talking about maybe more the transgenderism, but is to say, you know, the gender dysphoria.
Yeah.
I don't want to be cruel
again,
and just...
I think that lends more to the discussion of transgenderism.
Yes.
Because that is considered distinct from the gay and lesbian issue. Because someone who comes out as gay is not necessarily claiming that they're the opposite gender now.
Right. But it is, would still could say in all of those, they're abiological, meaning there's not a biological determinant to them being transgender or gay, or they weren't born a gay.
Correct.
They weren't born lesbian. It's not a biological issue.
Correct. Their decision to be transgender or their decision to be gay is not related to their biology. Yes.
Okay. So, all right. So in my mind, they're not really the same, though their classifications are similar in that they're just kind of man-made applications.
Yeah. Well, and you know, of course, rescuing devices do surface over years, because there was a time not too long ago when the idea of gay and lesbian were viewed even by its proponents as choices. And as people became more savvy about discussing the issue, you know, seeing that as changeable started to change. The rescuing device of, well, I was simply born this way and didn't know it. That became a rescuing device to further try and prove that it's a legitimate orientation.
It is interesting, you know, this issue, but also when I was dealing Sunday with the, I was studying for the issue, you know, thinking about the sanctity of life, it almost becomes at times frustrating / absurd, because it's like you have to like prove the obvious. You have to, you know, because they're like, well, that thing in you isn't a baby. Wait, what? Yeah. You know what I mean? Because they're trying to reterm the obvious to skirt around the conscience.
Yeah.
You know? And so I read an article, you know, when is your baby a baby? You know, and so it's discussing, you know, issues of viability, and, you know, when you choose to call your baby is up to you, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, but it doesn't change, you know, and it's interesting. I read a Harvard medical article on abortion, kind of like what to expect. Here's what they do. Here's, you know, the procedures and what and all that. But strangely absent in the entire article was the word life. They would call it pregnancy material, pregnancy tissue, but they won't call that thing a life, you know, because just like you said, they have learned, oh, well, if I call it a life, well, then we basically just like cut out our own legs.
Well, I mean, you can even see rescuing devices present in that discussion, in how abortion used to be touted that it should be safe, legal, and rare, because people did understand that it was a human life. And over, you know, time, science and biology did, in fact, prove it is a life, And then mm-hmm. furthermore, it proved, well, the question was, well, then is it a human life or is it simply part of the mother? Well, now science has determined, yes, it is human life. So now the discussion has changed even further. Well, we will admit that based on biology, it is a human life, but it's not a person. So ultimately, like, the goalposts keep moving.
Right, and right now is where you go.
So yeah, now the debate is about personhood, which really deals with the consciousness, the soul, the issue of the consciousness and the soul. We, of course, believe that life, human life, is made up of a living soul.
Right.
Whereas if you view things from a purely naturalistic perspective, they have no justification for even acknowledging an immaterial thing like a soul.
At all.
Yeah.
Right.
So they're only left to deal with the consciousness and say, okay, the consciousness is something immaterial and it's what's present in a sentient human being. When does that start? And that becomes their criteria for when something is a person.
Interesting. That's a good explanation.
But, I mean, it depends on who you ask. Some would say, you know, it's based on when they're conscious. Well, then what do you do if someone is unconscious? Are you no longer a person when you sleep?
Right.
Are you no longer a person if you're in a coma?
Right.
So then they move the goalposts exactly again. Right. Well, it has to do with when they're viable. Okay, well, I mean, children aren't viable for a very long time after they're born.
Yeah, I mean, your college student's hardly viable. You know what I'm saying?
You know,
no, okay, maybe not.
Yeah, that's maybe an exaggeration. But, you know,
I mean, he can hardly survive away from his mom.
Yeah. But my point is that they keep moving the goalposts as the obvious becomes more obvious. They just keep having to change the terminology, move the goalposts, and change the nature of the arguments.
It's frustrating, but it's interesting. I mean, on the other hand, if you can just kind of drill down on some basic points, you know, yeah, it seems like it's helpful. You don't have to learn these complex.
Yeah. And, you know, even in scripture, the writers understood that when they were conceived, they used personal pronouns to refer to themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was conceived, it was a continuity of personhood.
Yeah,
of identity.
Yeah, and even, you know, Paul even acknowledged that from his mother's womb, God had a plan for his life. I think it was Paul called before he was born. I can't even remember where that is, but
maybe Jeremiah mentions that too.
Oh, maybe it was Jeremiah. Okay. I don't know.
But, all right, what's the next question on the docket for you?
Okay, let me take a look here. This one I thought was interesting. This was from a patron. This is from anonymous patron. And the subject is friendship. Mm-hmm. And the listener asks, a couple of episodes back, you guys were going to talk in the after show about the difficulties in having deep friendships in IFB circles. Would you consider this as a regular episode? I guess we should.
Since you asked, yes.
Since you asked. And since you are a patron, we will do that. I think it's an important topic. I've noticed cliques and overall reluctance from many at my home church to communicate authentically or get together outside of church. It creates an atmosphere of loneliness and fear of what is holding someone back from simply talking to or inviting for hospitality. Maybe share some tips of what you found as helped create meaningful relationships. And how do you, as ministry leaders, handle friendship inside the congregation? let me just preface this by saying if this is a genuine concern that you have, I would ask your pastor about it. Just out of curiosity to see what your pastor says, I would defer. Yeah. I would defer to him with it. You know, don't simply use us as a as a resource. I would talk to your pastor about it if you think that there's friendships in your church that are lacking, or maybe there's some insincerity or something, or cliques. And I think that would maybe help with not contributing to it. as far as friendships in churches, I have a personal opinion of why I think the independent fundamental Baptist church structure often seems to have difficulty with real friendships. And I'm saying this as a person who's been in these types of churches his whole life. What I've noticed is when you're a kid, you tend to be able to have real friendships at church. Hmm. And even into your teenage years, you mm-hmm. can. But as you become an adult, especially then once you get married, there seems to be very few real sincere friendships in church. Not that you're not friendly with each other, but I wonder if part of it just has to do with the distance of adulthood. But mm. my other theory is that as a movement, and again, you know how we feel about calling us a movement, there does seem to be a tendency for people to present themselves at church as one way hmm. and something else at home and at work or wherever else they go. Because church is obviously a very holy place in our mind. When we're there, we know that there's maybe some sort of social expectation of our character and our decency and our respectability and our separation. So we present ourselves at church in one way. The problem is that if that isn't the real you, you're going to feel uncomfortable really getting close to those people there.
For fear of being
for fear of being
exposed.
Exposed, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So inviting them over your house might feel uncomfortable, or meeting them outside of church might feel uncomfortable, or even having conversations that are too detailed or too personal. So people tend to keep each other at arm's length when there is hypocrisy present. That's my theory. Mm-hmm. It's personal theory here. So I wonder sometimes if maybe that's why churches that really place a high emphasis on holiness and separation and Bible preaching, I think there's oftentimes a struggle for real friendships in that church, because what you're naturally going to have when holiness is held as a high thing, you're statistically, you're just not going to have a whole lot of people that really get on board with that.
Hmm. On board with you're saying a list of standards?
Not a list of standards. I mean genuine holiness in the life.
Okay. Yeah. They're not going to get on board with really living that out.
I think any monkey, you know, could keep a list of standards. So a human, I think, could maybe do that even better. so I'm not talking about keeping a list of standards. I mean genuine holiness. If you hold that high in your church, it'll be a small percentage of the people that really get on board with that, especially if you're in a large church. So you're naturally going to have these distances between people.
Okay. Interesting. My take is, I think there's a few angles on it. And of course, you know, a man that hath friends must show himself friendly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's always two sides of it. On the one hand, I think that socially speaking, some people, you know, it may be kind of a learned and acquired ability to be hospitable, that mm-hmm. when you, you learn to invite people over, or you learn to even be inviting in your personality. 'Cause I mean, how many people, and I guess we have our holidays, you know, we get together with family. Mm-hmm. And some families, some personalities may lend more to having more company, but other people might just never have anybody in their home, and they're perfectly content that way. They just like their place the way it is. They don't want anybody to intrude in that. Partly it's a personality thing. But if you realize, that, hey, you know, we ought to be interacting with brothers and sisters in Christ, and, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes after the service isn't really always a sufficient, adequate time to do that. Yeah. And people might have the mistaken idea too, that it all has to be done through the church. Like, we need more activities, you know, but we'd say, well, you know, you're free to invite people over, you know, the people of the church can invite each other over and be a network and be a family and be a community. It doesn't have to be like through a program or on the calendar of the church necessarily. So there's different reasons, and yes, I think it could go to a spiritual reason, and part of it, and again, I'm not generalizing about every individual who calls himself a fundamentalist or fundamental Baptist. I know, sweet, genuine, sincere people, things like that, but as we're aware that some have obviously tended to make maybe we could say, make holiness into a definable list of appearances and of regulations. Well, if you say, well, for whatever reason, for the pastor's sake or for Jesus' sake or for my kids' sake, I'm going to adhere to those rules, you know? Mm. Well, what that develops in a person, if they're not really fully doing it just because they want to know and love the Lord, that comes with a judgmental spirit that now I not only judge myself by those standards, but I judge you by those standards. And if you don't, you know, I don't watch these shows, but you do watch these shows. I don't wear these things, but you do wear these things. You know, mm-hmm. my daughter does her hair this way, but I've noticed your daughter does her hair that way. You know, whatever. Well, in that kind of environment, it's hard to get close with people because maybe there's always the fear of being judged.
Yes.
Is if I invite them, you know, if I'm afraid if I go over to their house, you know, what are we going to talk about? Because if I mention a movie, they're going to judge me for watching that movie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or I wonder what they're saying about, you know, about the way my kids dress behind her, you know, whatever. Or vice versa, that, yeah, we'll have them over, but you understand, kids, that they don't have the same standards we do. You know what I mean? And so they can't, in a sense, be closer than, you know, they're not as grown and not as holy and not as whatever. And so, I don't know, I think that can present...
That's a good point.
Issue.
Yeah, and that kind of goes to the leadership part of our listener's question there. Mm-hmm. You know, how as church leaders do we try and mitigate this problem? And I think a lot of it does come down to leadership and how, you know, as pastors, do the people that attend your church know that they can be themselves in front of you completely, be themselves in front of you, and not be completely castigated by you, but at the same time know the things you do take issue with? You know, let me explain it this way. You know, we have a small church. You know, there are individuals at our church that are new Christians. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they let things slip out of their mouth from old habit that they say. Do they know I take issue with that? Well, sure. Sure they do. We've actually talked about it before from the pulpit and in counseling and conversation. It's not something that is a subject that hasn't been broached. But when something like that happens, and it doesn't happen often, we kind of just go on with the conversation. You know,
the environment is still one of loving acceptance and desire to see them grow.
Yes, but they know that I have an issue with it. It's not that we're ignoring the issue. We address issues. We always address issues in the right time and in the right way. We try to do that. It's not that every single time someone does something, you have to point a bony finger at them and rebuke them. I mean, one of the pastoral qualifications is to be patient. Mm. 1 Timothy 3:3, be patient, which carries with it.
Meekness.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of that one. In meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves.
Yeah, that's another one.
I mean, just, yeah.
Yep. And the idea of patience is gentleness. You know, it's a glory for a man to pass over a transgression. You don't have to stop and nail every single thing to the wall. And if people can know that the leader of the church, while he does take issue with unholy things, and we know what those things are, he's still friendly with me. He's still gracious to me. He still leads on softly. If they know that about the leader, I think it makes room for the people to treat each other that way.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I see. Leadership example.
Yeah.
He's setting the environment.
Yeah, and by no means am I suggesting that we ignore unholy things in the church.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that we never address those issues. I'm not suggesting that we just let everything and anything go. I'm not suggesting we never rebuke or reprove or exhort.
Right, but there's a place and a time and a way.
Yes.
To move from point A to point B with somebody to develop them, to bring them along, and it's not necessarily going to be in an embarrassing, demeaning, caustic environment.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it.
All right. We've got a few minutes left. What else do you want to finish up with?
Oh, I don't know. I was going to bring this up real quick because I thought it was an interesting resource. This is the subject on this one is protecting kids from pornography. And you had mentioned that you'd been teaching on technology in the home. This article is from a website called Protecting Young Minds. And it's not a Christian website, to my knowledge. I actually just found this today. But there was an article, 10 Ways Porn Culture Will Target Your Kids in 2020. Be prepared, not scared. And it made me aware of some things that are happening in culture that maybe some parents don't know that they're problems yet. one of the things they talk about is a website called Twitch. Have you heard of this?
I don't know. I might be thinking of a couple others kind of merged.
Yeah, it's a live streaming video platform. Most of the time, it says here gamers use it to live stream their games and interact through live chat. And because it's live, it's difficult to police what happens on the site. So even Twitch itself can't really police all of that because it's live. And they say in this article, it's become a real back alley of the internet. So they offer a number of helpful things you can do here with everything that they mentioned. So they talk about Twitch, and then they say, here's what you can do. The number three thing they mention here on the list is the dark web, which for a long time, to my knowledge, was something very difficult to get into and very dangerous to get into, as far as not just for your technology getting hacked and your information getting stolen, but a lot of immoral things in there as well. There's an app apparently that's a free download, and it's easy to download, and it gives anyone the key. It says here, quote, gives anyone the key to the most horrific and dangerous content down in the depths of the dark web.
Wow.
Yeah. So dangerous stuff there. one of the other points they make is about video game porn bots. Apparently, when people who have like an Xbox or a PlayStation, chat requests can pop up on the corner of the screen that solicit chats with pornographic things, pornographic information, which I figured video games were video games, right? Which I'm not familiar with either of those platforms, Xbox or PlayStation, but apparently they have access to the internet, and chat boxes like that can pop up.
Wow.
What I thought was really neat about this article, and I'll include it in the show notes, is because it links to a number of other resources. So if you're a parent who's maybe not very tech savvy, and your kids are old enough that they're maybe using the internet as part of their schoolwork or something else that they need to do, and you want to make sure they're protected, there's a lot of helpful resources in this article, and it's broken down very easily so that anyone can figure out really what to do. Even giving step-by-step instructions for every platform on how to set up a PIN code and parental controls. Because they talk about streaming content services like Netflix. And they say that's another dangerous one. And I just think it's a good article to help people be aware of what's going on.
That's great. And so you're going to link that to the show notes, right?
Yeah.
And remind me of that website again. What was it called?
It's called Protect Young Minds.
Okay, because I found one a while back, and I get periodic emails from them, protectyoungeyes.com.
Okay.
And it also, I thought, was a good resource, and what I looked at, if you go to the website, talking about, you know, different, like you say, different apps and just the dangers of them and how to, you know, what to watch out for. So those, yeah, I'm glad that we bring that up because, you know, parents need some good resources. They're not going to know everything about tech. None of the young people know everything about tech. But the availability, the possibilities that come to bear with technology are phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's like hit the home like a tidal wave.
Yes.
And all of a sudden you get this device and you say, oh, I'm going to get my kid a phone. So when they're at, you know, when they're after school, they can contact me. If you get them a smartphone, you just opened up about, you know, 325 things for them to be able to do.
Yeah.
And they may not even know it, but you're putting something into their hands that's so powerful.
Yeah. And many don't even know that there are built-in features right into the firmware. Things like guided access, screen time, filters. A lot of these platforms have it built right into the firmware, right. But it's not easy to find. It's not up front a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me as a parent, it was realizing that, you know, and it came when kids started getting Kindles, you know. Of course, I have technology already. My wife does, and the kids start getting it. Well, then my oldest son, he got a phone, you know, because he got this job, and I thought he needs to be able to contact me. Mm-hmm. Well, then you start, well, what about this, and what about this, and what about this? And started realizing, wait a minute, I need to sit down and really get a handle on what perimeters can we lay out there to control the use of technology in our home to be proactive about it, so that it's not just constantly throwing decisions at my way and I have to just make these rules on the fly, but try to, you know, get. So anyway, over time, I've been developing, it's not finished yet, but been developing just some overarching principles that can really apply to several areas of life, but especially can apply to the technology that we use. And to say, and what I dealt with Sunday, just a brief note on it, was basically, you need to determine who you are and what you do, you know, vocationally, but what does God want you to do? Then you go to the tool and you say, is this tool useful to me? And if so, how?
Yeah.
But I don't go to the tool and go, oh man, look at all that it can do. Oh, I want to do this. Oh, that looks flashy, because it's built. They pay them to make it, you know, engaging.
Yes.
You need to determine who you are, what you're doing, you know, where you're going, and then determine, is this tool going to help me get there?
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, an example of one of those principles that you lay down the principle first and then you judge the technology by it.
Yeah. Good point. I might have to hear more about that message in the after show.
Okay.
You'll have to tell me about that. If you listeners would like to hear the rest of that discussion, you can become a part of this show by going over to patreon.com/reasontogether. Sign up to be an elite member of the Reason Together podcast, and you will have access to the after show conversations. We do one after every episode, and it is exclusively for elite patrons over at patreon.com/reasontogether. If elite is not quite your fancy, you can pick something below that. Any tier below that, there's perks that come along with it, and you'll help us in supporting this podcast and getting this content out on the internet. Anyway, we encourage you to come back and listen to us on the next episode and join the conversation. Send us your feedback, anything you might think of, to reasontogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Again, thank you for listening. We are encouraging balance, developing perspective, and connecting faith to practice. This is Reason Together.